Tangent by Hope Chan, read by Rivervella. There's a story Sam heard once. He doesn't remember it well. Back during World War II, it sticks in his head, someone famous, maybe Walter Cronkite, maybe Edward Murrow, was looking out a London window and watched a fire truck go by. And Cronkite thought to himself that it was just the damnedest thing. The world was ending all around them, destruction raining from the sky each day, and yet, out there in the city, to one family, the Blitz meant nothing at all. All around them, their world was ending, yet to them this rain of fire was no worse than the fire in their homes. While their dad had died in late September, had taken a bullet in what turned out to be just a mugging gone wrong, everyone else had died in early May. No difference. Baton Rouge is desolate, and Dean is jumpy. Sam's far enough gone not to care about the former, but no migraine in the world could keep him from noticing the latter. "It's a sleepy city, Dean," he winces when his brother pulls sharply to the right, sliding messily in behind a Ford parallel parked on the side of the street. "Sleepy, sure." Dean hesitates, his fingers drumming an anxious tattoo on the steering wheel. "Sure as hell shouldn't be comatose." With that, he opens the door and steps out, goes up to peer in the Ford, then turns toward one of the townhouse stoops. Sam waits, because he always has license to wait when he gets like this, and rolls down a window and tries to ignore the heat and humidity and the faint rotting stink of the air. It's the first time in a long time they've been inside a city's limits. Their patterns have changed in the past few months, because Dean's come to hate having to comfort people. He'd come to hate having to deal with them, out of some misplaced resentment for their dad and his fate. Their job's still their job, but now it's nothing more than a job, and something less. It's habit more than anything else, really. Just catch wind of a spirit and eliminate it. No congratulatory lap around town after. No cheap girls in sawdust bars, or little kids that need reassurance. No handshakes. Nothing. Dean likes it that way, not having to have hope, not having to give it. Sam's not that far gone, but it is easier this way. So they sleep in the Impala, or in salt circles on the ground. And they eat tins of soup, heated on a hot plate, plugged into the car's cigarette lighter. They go into towns when they're out of salt, soup, or gas, or when a tip or a headache steers them that way. Dean's suddenly leaning towards the window. Sam jumps a little. "No one home," Dean says, and circles around to get in on his side. He slams the door, loud enough that Sam resents him a little, broods enough that Sam forgives him, and then looks over. "Any of your," he waves his hand vaguely around his forehead, "you know?" "I haven't seen anything," Sam says, now, as ever, unable to avoid that self-conscious little stress. "Hopefully," he offers. "Maybe it's just a headache." Dean scoffs. "I'd be pretty surprised." He starts up the engine again, checks the rearview mirror from habit rather than expectation. "You keep your inner eyes open, you hear?" he says, with irony just as self-conscious. They're halfway to the police station before Dean adds, darkly, "And you always be on your toes anyway, Sammy. A thing doesn't have to be supernatural to be vicious." Sam isn't sure what he hates more, that it took Dean so long to say that, or that Dean said it at all. For once, they don't need a cover story. But it's been a while, so for old time's sake, they come up with one anyway. They're college buddies, taking a year off, visiting Americana, and worried by the fact that the Deep South's even quieter than they've heard. But even though they loiter around for some time, they don't run into a single person at the police station. The phone doesn't ring. The computer isn't on. The hot plate under the coffee's still going, but the coffee itself is literally sludge, so Sam turns it off before it catches fire and burns the place down. When he turns away, Dean's watching him with his elbows braced against the desk behind him, a single crease in his brow. Any ideas? Sam shrugs and fiddles with a plastic straw he picked up and tries to ignore the throbbing in his temples. Maybe. No one's on the street. Could be a piper, maybe. Maybe they all have the flu, Dean. Christ, I don't know. Christ! He bites out, sharper with a spike in the pain. When he opens his eyes again, Dean's frowning a little more. Pretty bad one, huh? He asks. Yeah. Somehow the migraine makes it come out bitter rather than neutral, and Dean folds his arms across his chest. We'll stop by the drugstore then. Get you some Advil or something. Advil doesn't do anything, Sam says, his tone more accusatory than he intended. And if the police station isn't open, why the hell would the drugstore be? So Dean snaps. Well, fuck, Sammy. I'm trying to help, but I guess I just can't. It's Dean's mini freakout that makes Sam, despite the headache that shrinks everything else, realize just how fucking big this all is. They've seen things that can draw the inhabitants out of a town before. But out of a city this size? Sam's almost glad of the migraine. It keeps this from seeming as monstrous as it is. Halfway down a side street, it gets so bad that Sam begs Dean to pull over and let him out. He spends the next 5 minutes gagging over a gutter. Dean passes him a water bottle, and he drinks it gratefully because it gives him something to throw up. Almost immediately, he feels better and goes and sits in the Impala with the door open and his feet dangling over the side, finishing off the water in slow sips. The nausea has faded, so now he only has the headache to contend with. Dean looks him in the eye to make sure he's well enough to go on. Sam nods. Hospital loading dock, Dean observes, with great significance. They circle around to the front. They find their first sign of life inside. A single, greasy-haired man, sitting at the reception desk in a booth surrounded by glass, with his hands in latex gloves and bags under his eyes, looks up at them warily as they come in. It's almost a relief to see him, but Dean pretends it's the most natural thing in the world to see this bureaucrat when there's no one else around, walking up and leaning towards the speaker embedded in the glass. "My brother here," he says, lying for the comfort of the act. "Gets these headaches, see, and we were hoping you'd have something for him before he boots all over my car." But the man is leaning away, fear on his face. And Dean drops the act, suddenly. "Look, can you tell us what's going on?" The man says nothing, and Sam steps forward. "Listen, sir, please. We've been on the road for a while here, and we get here, and we don't see anyone. Did something happen? Is there something going on?" And finally, at that, the man opens his mouth and speaks. His voice is thin, unaccented, and cracks with disuse. He clears his throat. "I don't really know much about it. He clears his throat again, a nervous habit, a pattern. "The plague, yeah? It's the plague, yeah?" Sam shakes his head. "I don't, what plague?" And the man just sort of stares at him, either contemptuous or confused. Dean steps in. "Look, man, like he said, we've been out on the road a long time. Been a while since we've seen anyone. We don't know a thing. Just tell us about it, would you?" Strange. Sam finds himself wondering if the man will see through their lie until he realizes that there's no lie to it at all. The virus lives in the epithelial cells, It replicates there, and that's where it's shed. It's short-lived. It can't survive on the air or on clothes, but it's incredibly infectious. A single touch can be a death sentence. The symptoms are largely flu-like, though tremors and numbness in the extremities are also common. Which makes sense, it's a disease of the nervous system. Paralysis occurs in the later stages. Death is by suffocation. Most people died in their homes, but the hospital is full of patients. They came and they died until the morgues were full, and then the staff started just stacking the bodies in the hallway. And at that point, there wasn't enough staff, so the bodies were just left in the hospital beds. That's when they stopped accepting plague victims, and people just died in their homes. Mortality rate is extremely high. Could be 100%. If they're really curious, there's a records room in the back. Technically, they're not supposed to go back there, but what the hell? It's not as if they could do any harm. If they see anyone, though, they should be careful not to touch. That includes corpses. "Why haven't you left?" Sam asks on the way out. The man's doing better now. He's not cringing and stuttering like he was before. Still a little timid, sure, but it's almost like even just talking to people made him better, helped him. "I still have a job. Yeah? I have to eat." "Yeah, and who the hell's paying you?" Dean snorts, gestures about him with the floppy disk in his hand. "World's ended, dude. You survived. Go steal yourself a nice car." The man hardly even seems to understand, and Dean leans forward. "You shouldn't be here. Go home." "When the hospital starts up again," the man says, but Dean interrupts him with laughter. Sam looks between the two of them and isn't sure which one he feels more embarrassed for. That night, they make a meal out of chips, warm beer, and supermarket chicken that's just starting to go long in the tooth. The store was locked, but they broke a window, and if there was a silent alarm, then no one was around to hear it. "How about that whimper?" Dean says as Sam checks his email. There are a few messages from Stanford, the latest dated 5 days previous. When he opens them, there are lists of the dead. He knows some of the names. This, for some reason, makes him want to grit his teeth and cry, when the news itself didn't. "What's that?" Sam stalls. "Whimper," Dean repeats louder. "You know, college boy, this is the way the world..." "Right." The New York Times website had been updated 2 days before, the front page dominated by an article on the plague. Below, though, there are still some human interest stories. Pandas, and the Yankees shut out of the Mariners, and an upscale chocolate boutique near Times Square. "You know, they have the Yankee scores here," Sam says, "but they're all probably dead now, aren't they?" "Only if we're lucky," Dean says, and spreads his hand when Sam looks at him. "What? Come on, Sammy. It was a joke." "Royals are dead, too." "Jesus," Dean grouses, crossing his arms before him. Sam looks back down. "Looks like it's the whole world infected. Asia, Europe, everything. Australia's done a quarantine, but..." He shakes his head at the speculation on the numbers dead despite it. "God. Long gestation period, apparently. The disease," he explains. "So you don't know who's sick until..." "Great." Dean picks apart a chicken wing before him, splitting the bone and scraping out the marrow with a thumbnail. "So we don't touch nobody," he says, staring resolutely at the marrow. "Dead or not. No knives." He looks up then. "Unless you think you can do your..." He gestures vaguely about his head. "Thing. With knives." "Dunno," Sam shrugs. "Maybe. I can try." "Be useful. And no touching each other either, too. Got it?" He goes back to studying the marrow. "None of those stupid chick flick hug it out moments you love so much. Think you can handle it?" He wipes the marrow off on the inside of his shirt sleeve. "I think I'll manage," said Sam, giving an exaggerated imitation of disgusted. "So you want to keep hunting then?" Sam says, after there's a disturbing moment of soundlessness. Demon's still out there. Dad would want us to. You think he has something to do with this? Sam wishes his brother would meet his eyes. I mean, my head aches. Dunno. Doesn't seem his style. You know? Dean shrugs. Why, just because there's no one left to save, you want to go back to college? Hate to break it to you, Sammy, but college is probably dead, too. Dean's voice is almost too bleak for Sam to take offense, but he manages a decent fuck you, nonetheless. He stares a while at sfgate.com. Someone evidently got onto the page after people stopped caring, and had replaced all the content on the page with the second stanza of Yeats' The Second Coming, stark black writing on a white background. But while that fascinates him, WashingtonPost.com horrifies him. They've done the same thing there, but the text is a blood-red, see you soon. At least the Yeats is poetic. So what do we do now? Sam asks, flipping the top down on the computer. I think there's some whiskey in aisle 6. Not a bad idea. I mean, in the long term, where do we go next? Guess we just check to see if anyone's still alive, Dean shrugs. There must be people like our friend the desk clerk, people who are uninfected. He grins without joy. Though I gotta say, Sammy, this new world of ours kinda sucks. It's gonna be populated by all the people in the world who couldn't get laid. At least we're gonna be the hottest guys left on Earth. He hesitates, takes a swig of beer. On the other hand, sex is a death sentence. Human race won't even live beyond this generation. Pretty fucking depressing. Yeah, Sam says, with all the irony he can muster. It's somehow, to Sam, a great endorsement of humanity. This was how they all went, hand in hand. Hadn't been for their dad, they'd have gone with everyone else. Maybe they should be thankful for that. 9 months later, he thinks he's going insane. Of their old contacts, only Bobby's still alive. He doesn't have tips for them anymore. He's just trying to survive. And no newspapers anymore, aside from small circulation things in the communities that have only started to form. And those are just cooperatives. More than anything else, just people working together to grow some food. No friendships there. Certainly no romances. And no children to be found anywhere. They died, of course, in enormous numbers, playing tag or Miss Mary Mac. Only adults have survived, and them in small numbers. So the only thing to be done is to follow Sam's head. He's no good in major cities, and after a while he figures out why. It's the weight of the unquiet dead that he senses. That's what causes the migraines. But in smaller towns he's been able to work with it, so that he can sense subtle differences in the pain. He can tell if it's just the regular dead, or malevolent spirits. Salting and burning's no good anymore. Too many corpses. But dealing with the spirit directly, that they can handle. They accomplish things. Occasionally, save a life or two. But it's all in vain, he always tells himself. 40 years and they'll all be gone. A world returned to the plants. There aren't going to be any more children unless someone, somewhere, plucks up the courage to embrace someone. But at least there's that. At least there's that hope. That faith in other people. But it's 5 months or more since he's felt another person's skin. He thinks to the times when Dean would clap him on the shoulder or grasp him by the hand with an almost delirious sort of longing. He remembers the rough warmth of Dean's grip, and occasionally he'll watch his brother through slitted eyes, pretending to be asleep so that he can watch the patterns Dean's skin makes when he swallows. They traffic in tea. The caffeine and the hot water manage the pain. He drinks enough, and they're in cities rarely enough that Sam has to ration it strictly. Each bag used no less than 3 times, and steeped for no more than 2 minutes, until the third steeping, where it should be left in for 10, so that this last mug is a mess, a nut-brown extraction of bitter tannins that lingers at the sides of the tongue. He drinks it with gratitude, and fortunately they're in cities enough that he's able to get the good stuff, raiding Chinese groceries and specialty stores with relief. Once they'd gotten loose leaf by accident. That night, Sam had swirled and drained the dregs, wondering idly if he couldn't see the future in it. His brother caught him at it, and the most worrying thing was that Dean doesn't say a thing, doesn't mock him at all. Because if Sam's going insane, Dean's already most of the way through the journey. See, because even though Sam tells himself 40 years and we're gone, Dean believes it. Dean believes it with all his heart. For him, 40 years is an overestimate. 30, 20, a month is all they have left. 'Cause sooner or later they're going to trip and fall on a corpse, and then game over. Fini. All he has is that empty satisfaction of watching another son of a bitch buy it. He's still as jokey as ever, still laughs just as often. But his sense of humor's getting darker by the day. He already laughs at the irony in some of the great cities of death. Only a matter of time before he starts laughing at their dad's death, too. Funny, though, the end of humanity only exacerbated this trend. Certainly didn't create it. It had started long before this, on a breezy Denver day in late September. Sam had had a vision in late October, and they'd raced to Victoria, Minnesota, just in time to find a house on fire, and a heartbroken man cradling an infant on the front lawn. After they'd explained things to the man, after he'd gone on his way, Dean had sat behind the wheel of the Impala and started to laugh. Business is fucking usual for him, I guess. And Sam had sat there, too, and watched the dying embers of this man's life, and felt, it was hard to define, and it made him feel like shit, but it was almost hope. February, they meet a grifter in the Galveston dust and give him a lift a while. He's a big man named Joe, with 2 weeks' worth of stubble, and he carries a crappy violin in a case. That night he takes it out before the firelight and holds it with reverence. "It's a Stradivarius," Joe says, his voice hushed. "A dying man gave it to me. He looked me in the eye and wheezed his dying words. Take this. It shouldn't be lost to the world." He starts to caress its neck, but fumbles and nearly drops it, and curses colorfully. "I'm no artist, though. I should give it to someone who'd appreciate it." Sam watches later as Dean twists at the pegs and says, "Why do you think he even bothered?" "Pleasure of the scam, I'm guessing," Dean says, "or habit, maybe," then plucks out a haphazard sequence of about 10 notes on the strings and looks up expectantly. Sam vaguely recognizes it. Dean shakes his head. "Smoke on the water, dude. Deep purple." He looks down, strums the Stradivarius like a ukulele. Sam crosses his arms. "And why did you bother?" Joe had asked for $100 for the thing. Dean had handed it over without even haggling. "Money's only so many pieces of paper now." "Government might come back eventually," Sam says. Maybe that was what he was going on. Maybe in the future, money'll be worth something again. Dean shoots him a look of utter contempt and moves on to plucking out something, which might be the guitar line to Stairway to Heaven. When Sam looks away, the music stops. 2 weeks later, everything falls apart. Dean wakes up with a nasty cough and a runny nose. The next day, his hands start shaking. "Looks like this is it, Sammy," he says, grim satisfaction in his voice. "It's stress," Sam says stubbornly. Dean laughs in his face. Sam drives into town for some NyQuil. He gives it to Dean. He pours it out and watches as Dean raises it to his lips with so much slopping over the sides. At least Dean sleeps then. Doesn't help with the flu, though. It doesn't help with the shakes. "Fuck," he whispers when he thinks Dean is asleep. Dean laughs again. "You'll get better," Sam says, often. "It's just nerves." "Stress," Dean suggests. "That's it." "Cute, Sammy," Dean grins. Dawn the next day, and Dean raises himself shakily to his feet. "This is it for me," he says. "It's been fun." Sam stands too. "Where the fuck are you going?" "I don't want you handling my body," Dean says. "You go off and keep at it." "It's stress," Sam says once again. "No, it's not." "Yes, it is. Dean," he says desperately. And Dean turns away then, his face lined deeply in the early morning light, halfway to madness now, because he's lived a life that's left him wrecked, because his tragedy was such that he didn't even get a chance to mourn. His was a house in the midst of burning houses, a little tragedy, no smaller than the big ones. And it's been a year, maybe more, since he's even felt the touch of human skin. So Sam, halfway to madness himself, reaches out and grabs his brother's hand. The touch is electric, and he doesn't regret a thing. "It's a matter of hope, see? That's all it is." The end.